What's better than one John?
Here's Johnny.
Nobody really knows. That's why we put two of them together. This is Canzano and Wilner,
a.k.a. John and John.
Welcome to the podcast, everyone, and we are going to start with a check-in on our patient. John, how is your recovery from knee surgery going? Are you mobile? Are you driving? Or are you just having everybody wait on you hand over knee?
I'm good, man. I'm feeling good. It was just an arthroscopic surgery, so a meniscus repair, a little shaving of the bone, the surgeon tells me, and I feel really good, and they encouraged me to get right into PT, so I've already had a PT appointment, and I'm just trying to get rid of some of the swelling, and I feel pretty good, and I came out of it all right. Like, I just don't do well with pain meds, Wilner. Like, I had a weird side effect to the pain meds. Let's start with that. I had hiccups, and last time I had a knee surgery, same thing. Whatever they give me, whatever they're prescribing these days, I'm in the 1% of people who get hiccups as a side effect. And so hiccups are not bad. You can get rid of them. But when you have them as a side effect of a medication and you can't get rid of them for 6 hours, that's a little bit of a problem. Like, yeah. It's worse than the knee surgery. So I stopped taking the pain meds. I went right to like Tylenol, Advil, Aleve. I feel really good. Nobody cares about my knee. They care as much about my fantasy league team as they do my knee. But I'm doing good. Thank you for asking.
So it was good that you timed your surgery so that you could basically spend 3 days watching the NFL draft. Is that how you spent the weekend?
I was locked into it, man. And the NFL, we all know the NFL's king. Like, you know, we assume that. We know that. It's given. But they have created this event where they brought more than 1 million people to Detroit. They created several days, filled up a bunch of hotel rooms, came up with a bunch of programming on multiple TV stations, and they make it palatable. Like, the NFL gets it far better than the NBA, Major League Baseball, NHL, or college athletics. There's a lot to learn there, but Roger Goodell's league is hammering it, and we saw it in the draft. And how about the Pac-12 in the first round? What'd you think of that?
Very Pac-12 to have, you know, its best overall draft ever. The year it's saying goodbye, right? It's just, you couldn't have scripted it any better in that regard. Very typical. So 8 picks in the first round, was one short of the record, 43 picks overall, which is a record for the 7-round draft. 7-round draft began in 1994. Previous record was 39, also set in 2015. So yeah, 43 picks. Really good. All but Colorado didn't have anybody picked, and Arizona State did not have anybody picked. Everybody else represented. Stanford had a kicker, but everybody was represented except for those two schools. It was and it reflected the quality of play we saw on the field last fall.
It just underscores the idea. There were like 15 picks in to the draft. 6 of them were Pac-12 players. You had Penix and Nix up high. You know, there was Caleb Williams at 1. And it hit you like a bag of bricks. Like, there was nothing wrong with the product. Like, a lot of businesses will fail. Corporations will wobble because the product's not good. This was all about leadership, all about management, the ecosystem wanting to, wanting more and more. Big Ten and SEC certainly wanting to own it all. We see that now. But there was nothing wrong with the Pac-12. And I think it was on display for all of the world and on the biggest platform in this NFL draft. And it just hits you like that was a great season in that last season. And Caleb Williams even talked about it a little bit in his introductory news conference. You know, what a great conference it was that he played in, and a lot of validation. What did you make of the Penix and the Nix picks?
Real interesting. And I read Sports Illustrated has got a very good look, in-depth look at why those two teams picked those quarterbacks and what they went through in the pre-draft process, how the coaching staffs and the front office staffs for the two teams kind of fell into Penix and Nix. It was real interesting. I'd recommend it for anyone. One of the takeaways was Denver went to go see Bo Nix in Eugene, I think it was in January, and they spent 3 hours meeting with him. And at the end of the 3 hours, Nick was getting ready to go do a workout, and he picked up his backpack, and I think it was Sean Payton, actually, who said, "What's in your backpack?" And Nick's explained the handful of things that were in his backpack. All of them were related to football, and that made a lasting impression on the Broncos because, you know, the NFL teams, they want guys that have talent, but they want players who love football. And Nick's, all he had in his backpack was football-related stuff. And that was one of the small pieces that drew them to him. And, there's stuff with Michael Penix and the Falcons kind of along those lines. And you can see everything that goes into the drafting of quarterbacks. It's so difficult to get right, and such an important piece for your franchise. But the whole thing's fascinating.
Six quarterbacks, history tells us that one or two are going to make it. And the rest of the GMs and the teams are going to look dumb. They're either going to look like they mismanaged it or they misjudged it. You know, it's one or two. And so I think, I get the criticism of the Broncos. People said they overpaid for Bo Nix. But if that's the guy you want and you're Sean Payton, you have to have him. And by the way, I think it works for Nix as well, because you've got a really heavily invested head coach in front office now that is going to be geared toward surrounding you with the pieces you need to be successful. I never viewed Bo Nix as a guy who was like a game-changing player who's going to put a team on his back and win the game. But if you put him in an offense that's built for him and you ask him just to distribute, be accurate, he is smart. He does not make mistakes. I get why Sean Payton fell in love with him. And I think 3 or 4 years from now, we may look back and go, hey, that, maybe he's one of the one or two that are still with the team that drafted him. And that ends up being like, you're not overpaying there if that turns out. So this is all a crapshoot and people are all judging it. And I'm going, just like pump the brakes here. Like Justin Fields, Mac Jones, Zach Wilson, this is a crapshoot. And I think the teams know that they need quarterbacks. And in the Penix case, Atlanta, you could see the enthusiasm and the joy in that draft room with the coach and the GM. They wanted Michael Penix Jr. And so even though they've got Kirk Cousins, they're going to be, half the league at about the midpoint of this next season, about half the league is going to look up and go, gosh, we don't have our forever guy at quarterback, or we don't have a guy we like even for right now at quarterback. And Atlanta's not going to be one of those teams. Atlanta's going to go, hey, this is the most important position on the field, and we've got two guys we really like. Now, did they handle draft day right? I don't think so, because at number eight, I want to solve a problem. And I think probably unknowingly they create a problem by drafting another QB without really talking to Kirk Cousins. So you create a little locker room rift. But I think they got two players they really like. And we'll judge them in 3 years. They're either going to be idiots or they're going to be brilliant.
Well, and here's the fascinating connection between Nix and Penix and the Broncos and the Falcons, and it's the Saints. And this is part of the Sports Illustrated story. The Falcons GM, Terry Fontenot, was on the Saints front office staff when Sean Payton was coaching the Saints. And in 2017, I think it was, they had identified their quarterback of the future in the draft, and they were picking 10th, and they have filled out their draft card, and they are all set to hand in their draft card when Kansas City trades up to number 9 to draft Patrick Mahomes. The Saints thought they had Mahomes locked up, and all of a sudden the Chiefs make a trade to move in front of the Saints and grab Mahomes. And that situation had a huge impact on how the Falcons GM, Terry Fontenot, because he came over from the Saints, he's now running the Falcons draft. It had a huge impact on how he viewed getting Penix, and also on how Sean Payton, now coaching the Broncos, viewed drafting Nix. Both of those guys have been scarred from missing out on Mahomes with the Saints, 8 years ago? And the way the Chiefs made that last minute trade to get up one spot ahead of the Saints and draft Mahomes. And it's fascinating the ripple effect that's had on the two franchises that we're talking about with Nix and Penix.
And look, all the quarterbacks that went high, I don't blame the teams for taking them. But I also thought to myself, gosh, are the real winners teams like Arizona and the Chargers, who end up getting Marvin Harrison Jr. and Joe Alt at 4 and 5. Maybe those guys, if you redraft this thing 3 seasons from now, those guys are the number 2 and number 3 picks, right? I mean, there's going to be some problems with Caleb Williams, Jaden Daniels, Drake May. They're not all three going to pan out. Also, some value, you know, with the Titans taking Latham, the offensive tackle from Alabama, and Roma Dunze at 9, and certainly Brock Power. Brock Bowers goes 13th. You redraft this draft, you know, 3 seasons from now, and you're going to see all of those guys move up in the same way you would redraft in the 2021 draft, and you'd say Penei Sewell is probably the number 1 or number 2 pick in that draft because of what happened with all the QBs. It's just, it's interesting to kind of watch this stuff unfold and see how it goes.
He is John Canzano, johncanzano.com. I'm John Wilner, Pac-12 Hotline at Bay Area News Group. And let's if you don't mind, let's stay on the draft, but look a little bit ahead, because we're talking about the quarterbacks. One of the big winners this year is Shedeur Sanders, because next year, I mean, I think part of the reason there was such a huge run on the quarterbacks in the first round is it's a kind of a bleak outlook for QBs in next year's draft. And Shedeur Sanders, along with Carson Beck from Georgia, they're like the top two guys. Shedeur Sanders could end up being a top 5 pick next year.
I watched Colorado's spring game. It was interesting to kind of see how they approached it. The offensive line looked a little better, but it was hard to tell because they were playing kind of a two-hand touch game. You know, Coach Prime didn't want to get anybody hurt. They were just kind of saying, you know, no tackling. And the offensive line was kind of blocking, but not really. And, of course, Colorado looked good, and Shedeur looked good, and it was nice to see him not get sacked 50 times, right? But so much of this next season really does come down to how can they protect him, and are they playing against better competition, maybe competition that's about the same? Certainly, if you go back to last year, the opening few weeks of the season, they handled TCU, they handled Nebraska just fine. You know, are they going to get more of that in the Big 12 versus maybe getting sacked 11 times against Utah, you know, or whatever Utah throws at him? So I, you know, he is set up for a nice season. And I think he's got that kind of talent. And you're right, the draft in a year, it'll be guys like Jalen Milroe, Cam Ward at Miami. It'll be Dylan Gabriel at Oregon, Carson Beck, certainly. I think there's some guys that you look forward to next season. And I would put Shedeur right up in the top 1 or 2 right now.
Yeah, Travis Hunter, too, Colorado's cornerback receiver, could be top 10 pick. I went through the list for, you know, all the schools out west in terms of trying to figure out who are the top prospects for next season. And it's interesting because Colorado and Arizona, they at this point have more, you know, high round draft guys than say USC or Washington. Now that may change once the transfer portal machinations unfold here in the next few weeks. But there's a little bit of a difference in how the talent is distributed, except for one thing. Oregon is just completely loaded. The more I look at their roster, the more I think, you know, they really could go toe-to-toe with Ohio State to win the Big Ten, because Ohio State is completely loaded. But Oregon, boy, it might be the best roster they've had, especially with Gabriel.
It is, in their big. And that Nick Eliotti, the longtime Oregon D coordinator, was watching the spring game, and he said, you know, this is the biggest Oregon team I've ever seen on the hoof. He used livestock terminology, Wilner. It was like he was, you know, and you're looking at guys like Josh Connerly, who's offensive tackle. Oregon's two offensive tackles are just massive. They both should be possible first-round picks. Connerly and Johnny Cornelius, big, giant guys. I don't know about the quarterback position, because Bo Nix was so good, and I think the thing that made Bo Nix really especially good for a college team is he didn't make mistakes. Some of that was his age and experience. Some of that was Bo. He was just very accurate. I think Dylan Gabriel will make a few more mistakes than Bo Nix made. I think, you know, everyone kind of expects that. But I think that room in general with Dylan Gabriel and Dante Moore and Austin Novosad, and, you know, they had like 3 or 4 guys that I went, gosh, they're deep at quarterback, and they've got guys. So, you know, and Tez Johnson out catching passes. And so I think they'll be fine. And I think you're right that they are kind of built to hit the ground running in the Big Ten. I don't know if they can beat Ohio State, even though that game's at home. I think that one is circled on everybody's calendar. But I think Oregon is looking to take a step forward, even after, you know, having a real nice season a year ago.
They are much better positioned to compete at the top of the Big Ten than Washington is, USC and UCLA, for sure. Much better. It's going to take better, bigger, more physical play on the lines of scrimmage to compete in the Big Ten. And Washington is rebuilding on both sides. UCLA, you know, pretty good on both sides last year. I don't know what it'll be like coming up. And you know, USC, we know their defense has been so flawed. I think Oregon is, it's not even close. The Big 12 outlook for the four corner schools, you know, Arizona and Utah, I think, are both in good shape there. But with the big, the guys, the teams going to the Big 10, I mean, Oregon stands alone in terms of being ready to go.
The national championship game, Michigan just runs all over Washington. And, you know, it was like 303 rushing yards to 46 rushing yards. I mean, that was the rushing disparity in the title game. And so Oregon even remembers in 2015 when they played Ohio State for the national title, the first CFP title game, Ezekiel Elliott, Cardale Jones, they ran all over Oregon too. And so, you know, I think, you know, Oregon obviously wants to be in the Big Ten. That's where they're headed. But you're right. They are built for it. And I had a chance, partly because of the knee injury, to just kind of flip around all of the Pac-12 spring games that have been played so far. And it did see big differences in kind of how these teams are built. I like, you know, Colorado added some beef on the offensive line. Utah did a really nice job, as Andy Ludwig does, in giving Cam Rising kind of a nice, comfortable spring game where he was completing passes. And sometimes in a spring game, you'll see a coordinator who will call plays and you'll go, he's looking to see, can the quarterback make this play? I never felt that at any moment with Cam Rising. It was Andy Ludwig going, I know my guy can do this. I know my guy can do this. High completion percentage, easy, couple touchdowns. It was really nice. I thought Washington State's got a true freshman running back. We had about a 40-yard reception for a touchdown. And the thing I thought about Washington State's spring game, Wilner, was that they had fun. Some of these spring games, and I watched some Big Ten games too, took themselves very seriously. Everybody looked stoic. Everybody looked a little stressed. Players looked tight. And the two games that I thought the players were really joyful were the Oregon spring game and the Washington State spring game. They just looked like they were having fun. And Washington State started with a reverse flea flicker touchdown pass on the very first play. And Oregon was having fun and had a concert afterwards. And everybody was kind of just smiling.
Cougars need some fun, as does Oregon State, right? They've had tough few months. And that is a topic I thought we should touch on briefly, at least. Are you hearing anything new on the state of a media rights deal for the Cougars and Beavers?
Scott Barnes, the AD at Oregon State, told me 8 or 10 days ago that they were in extra innings and they were about to close it out. I do think they waited a little bit because I think they're finalizing one or two little pieces here, but I expect it's going to be the CW. I think they're going to go with wide distribution. He sort of confirmed that in our talk where he said, you know, they went after distribution, not revenue. I think they're trying to marry it with some kind of marketing campaign nationally because, you know, it's one thing to be on 99.5% of the households, but when you look at the ACC games from a year ago, the ratings weren't great for the rank and file game. If there was a really good matchup, yes, you got a number. But I think they're going to have to do some things to market themselves. They may have to spend some money. I think you said it like a week ago, like, you know, they should pay for the exposure if they can get it. I actually think they are. I think they're going to invest in a big marketing campaign to try to push out Washington State, Oregon State. This is where you find them. They're on the CW. And then the kickoff times, I think, are going to be real favorable for fans. I think people are going to love seeing a daylight kickoff.
I think that's critical, too, is they need to be on as often as possible. You know, they need to start the games as often as possible by 5 p.m. Pacific, right? Well, anywhere from 12:30 to 5 p.m. Because that gives you more exposure, not only with the people watching live, but then you can get your highlights on the Fox and ESPN studio shows, the highlight shows. You can get them on all night, right? You get a big win. Somebody scores three touchdowns. They're going to be on, you know, SportsCenter and whatever else ESPN Fox have got going on all the way through the night. If you start your game at 7:30 and it ends at 10:45, those studio shows, the highlights become moot because nobody's watching the highlight shows at 2:00 in the morning on the East Coast. And then when people get up, it's NFL. So that has always been an underrated disadvantage of the night games is the lack of exposure on the highlight shows that they get.
I have a friend who used to work at the paper I was working at on the West Coast, and he moved to Tampa. And he told me shortly after arriving there, I said, "What's the biggest difference?" And he says, "At about 5 or 6 o'clock, it just goes dark." And he said, "We don't really tune into the NBA or the Major League Baseball games that are being played at night on the West Coast." And I think you're going to see Oregon State, Washington State try to chase the window a little bit to that respect. And I think fans are going to enjoy, like, you know, if you're a Washington State fan who's driving to a game, this is going to give you a chance to see a game during the day and get home on time and not have this, you know, have to stay over or have, you know, get home at 3 o'clock in the morning. And Oregon State fans, the same way. I think Oregon State really got conditioned to be in that 7 o'clock window. And granted, they're probably still going to see some late games when they play the Mountain West schools on the road. They'll be on Fox or they'll be on CBS and you've got, you know, or ESPN, and you've got those games in those windows. But I think the home games will largely be daylight kickoffs. That's what I'm expecting.
That'll work, you know, on a lot of fronts. That'll work. What did you think? We did not get to this last week during our recap of the first round of the NFL. But it was big news last week on the college level. What did you think about the Heisman finally giving Reggie Bush his trophy back?
I had mixed feelings. On one hand, like, you know, here I am at like ground zero for the Jailblazers era that was, you know, there was the yellow Hummer and everybody saying, you know, there's a marijuana problem. And now you look nationally and there's a real change of attitude or a shift of mentality when it comes to that. And so there's been sort of an acceptance of it. But what Reggie Bush did at the time, Wilner, was against the rules. And so I get that the Heisman Trust is saying, hey, this is widely accepted now. Let's get him his trophy back. But I sort of expected that Reggie would then in turn say, I'm dropping my lawsuit against the NCAA. You know, he's being petty. He's going all the way to the end zone on this thing. He's not, his defamation lawsuit has just picked up steam, I think. So I had mixed feelings. Like, I was happy to see kind of a, you know, we all sort of accept that there's an injustice. And then I'm a little apprehensive about, like, okay, what's the fallout now? Rick Pitino wants his banner back. You know, you got SMU and other programs looking in hindsight. Are we going to retroactively right all of those wrongs, or are we going to acknowledge that some of this stuff was against the rules and people broke rules? I don't know. What did you think?
For me, the whole thing with Reggie and the Heisman gets back to one person, OJ. I just cannot reconcile the fact that OJ didn't have his Heisman. I mean, double murder, right? Whatever the courts say, everybody knows. And here's the Heisman. Not only are they not asking for his trophy back, but when he died, what was that, 3 weeks ago? And I'm convinced there was a connection here. He dies 3 weeks ago. The Heisman sends out this, like, on Twitter or X, you know, they send out the sympathy note to his family, you know, where the Heisman Trophy Trust is mourning the loss of O.J. Simpson. And I'm thinking, you got to be kidding me. Meanwhile, Reggie doesn't have his Heisman. And I think there's a connection because they got a lot of pushback on that O.J. thing. And to me, the timing of his passing and the announcement that Reggie was finally getting his trophy, I think it just looked that bringing OJ back into the news, no matter for whatever it was, it just underscores how ridiculous it was that Reggie didn't have Heisman and OJ had his. That to me, that's what it all got down to. I'm I'm not thinking quite as big as you are and trying to connect all the dots with the other situations and with his defamation lawsuit. It's just, how can you justify letting OJ keep his and not giving Reggie his? I mean, come on.
I get that. I totally get that. But my mind went to like Rick Pitino.
Where's
my banner? You know,
right? No, that's totally legit. Totally legitimate. If you're trying to extrapolate, and it's a really good conversation to have. No, within college sports, all those situations. But you know, none of the other ones have that OJ factor.
I'm John Canzano. You can read me at johnconzano.com. He's John Wilner, Bay Area News Group. You can find him at Pac-12Hotline.com. We got time for a little more. What do you want to hit next?
I think we need to hit the biggest news of all, because the future of the NCAA is involved. If you don't mind, a quick walk down the legal road here. ESPN reported that the NCAA and the power conferences are working on a settlement for this lawsuit. It's called the House lawsuit. House is named after Grant House, a former ASU swimmer. And we have mentioned this on the podcast previously, but it is worth repeating. This is the lawsuit that could bring down the NCAA as we know it, because it is billions of dollars in potential damages and in future revenue that the schools would have to pay out. And a lot of these schools can't afford all this money. So basically what has happened is the SEC and the Big Ten are trying to create this new model for college athletics as part of a settlement deal with the plaintiffs. And they feel like if they could settle with the plaintiffs for $1 billion in damages, they can avoid going to court and incurring $4 billion worth of damages. So according to ESPN's report, each school was basically going to, if the settlement works out as it kind of in the direction it's heading, each school is going to kind of have to take $20 million a year and use that on an annual basis to pay NIL money for the athletes. And if you think about the financial shape for a lot of these schools, right? I mean, many of the schools in the Pac-12 are reporting operating deficits anywhere from $10 million to $20, $30 million with subsidies from campus. And then you throw on this new $20 million annual budget item expense. It's really going to cause potentially a financial crisis, the likes of which we haven't seen. And it has scared college athletic officials, this lawsuit, more than any lawsuit that's come in front of taken on the NCAA. This scares people more than anything else, and that's why they're trying to settle before the trial date in January. I know that's kind of a long explanation, but trust me, this lawsuit is a big, big deal, and it's going to create a revenue-sharing framework for the athletes, and it's going to change college sports as we know it.
I think you're going to get a lot of opposition from some schools that simply cannot afford this, that are going to say, this is pay-to-play. We can't afford to do this, but that's sort of the point of what the Big Ten and the SEC are doing. I think they're going, okay, we're going to separate the haves from the have-nots. You talk about 10 to 20, you know, let's say the number's 20 million a year. That's 8% of Ohio State's athletic department budget. But you look at Boise State, you know, that 20 million, that same $20 million is upwards of 30 to 40% of their athletic department budget. It's simply not sustainable for a lot of schools. I also think there's a Title IX element in this that, you know, do you have to, if you're going to pay $20 million, do you have to spread that across non-revenue generating sports, or is it just football and men's basketball? And if athletic departments have to make those decisions, are they then cutting? Are they cutting volleyball? Are they cutting softball? I mean, what's going to happen to the Olympic sports?
A lot of unknowns, and the Title IX aspect is certainly one of them. There's no question it's going to just continue the separation that we've seen, right? I mean, the $20 million number, it is designed basically for the for the schools in the SEC and the Big Ten because they can afford it. And from there, you get to tiers where it becomes more and more difficult for the budgets. Eventually, we're going to get to the point where it's just two separate tiers in college football. Right now, that exists, but you know, it's not official. The settlement in the House lawsuit is going to basically make it official. And the group, the future for the Group of Five schools is very difficult to kind of map out because they can't afford this. I mean, there's a lot of schools in the ACC and the Big 12 that are going to really struggle as well. So I just think people, you know, we don't like to force the legalese on folks and all these issues, but this one is just such a big deal. It's going to change college sports. It's going to change the game, not the way it's played, but how we experience college football. It's going to shift because of this House lawsuit.
I have a source who was involved in doing some consulting work for one of the sides on the lawsuit. And the source sort of tipped me off very early and said, this is important. This is going to be groundbreaking. Nobody was talking about this, Wilner, early on. Is it because it's so inside baseball that this class action lawsuit kind of, you know, got overshadowed by realignment? What do you think happened? Why was it flying under the radar so much?
Well, a lot of it is because the legal issues aren't, you know, how much does the public care about it? Part of it's because college administrators who end up talking to the media the most, which is coaches and athletic directors, either didn't understand it or didn't want to say anything because they're so concerned about going public with legal matters. And part of it is, too, that it wasn't given class action status until, I believe it was November. So that's when all of a sudden things escalate, because once it gets class status, you know, the damages triple. And that's when the NCAA and the schools are going, oh, instead of $1.5 billion, this thing could cost us $4 or $5 billion. So it's only been in the last few months that it has taken on this, you know, doomsday shape, because it's the same judge, Northern District, California, same judge, Claudia Wilkin, who ruled on the Ed O'Bannon case many years ago, the famous case that started NIL. She's got this one, and she's the one who approved the class status, and that's when everything escalated back in November.
The NCAA does not have a good win percentage in court, so keep that in mind as well. So
it's like 0 for 12.
They'll take the settlement. Thank you very much.
Anything else on your mind?
I mean, that's it. I mean, I think you kind of hit on it. Just the spring games are in the books. I think we're gonna start ramping up with some good guests coming up. We'll start previewing the various seasons and the various conferences. If you have an idea for a guest you'd love us to interview, you can tweet at John Wilner, at Wilner Hotline. Tweet at me, at John Canzano, BFT. Tell us who you would love to hear an interview with. We'll have much more ahead. Make sure you subscribe as well to the podcast. Reach out and make that commitment so you get it and you have it easily digestible right there on your mobile device.
Thanks very much, everyone.